Welcome to the weekly edition of the Pain Points of Wealth, the podcast that addresses all the pain points that come along with creating, growing, and sustaining your wealth. Hosted by the family wealth experts of Pain Capital Management, Bob, Ryan, and Chris Payne. Send us any questions or comments you may have to questions at paincm.com, and please enjoy this week's episode.
And that's actually a good question, Bob. You know, I always found that engineers don't typically make good investment managers. So surprising you made that leap, and you actually did it successfully because I saw the numbers on your fund for 30 years, annualizing 11%. That's pretty good for an engineer.
Well, that's been my problem, huh? Now you tell me. I'm in the wrong business.
What made you make the switch? And do you think that was a detriment, or it helped you that you were actually an engineer?
When I worked as an engineer, it was research-oriented. I was in the aerospace industry, working for Pratt & Whitney, and then later on GE. So I felt the discipline involved in doing research was very helpful. Understanding physical processes, you know, if I read about an oil refinery, I know what's going on there. You know, it wasn't a mystery to me. So, I always felt comfortable with my engineering background. And it's certainly math oriented as well. And there's a lot of math in my mind and in the investment business. Never felt really that uncomfortable. And, you know, I learned what I had to learn, or I thought I did, on my own.
You know, I also came from kind of an engineering background. I worked in a disaster recovery business doing IT recovery. You know, so what spawned the change for you? I mean, that's a lot of people would say that's a drastic move.
The realities of raising a family. I had an undergraduate degree in chemical engineering and a graduate degree from Rensselaer in nuclear science. When I was working at Pratt & Whitney, I got the nuclear science degree, and then I came down to GE and we worked on a nuclear project for the aerospace industry. And after that was completed, there were like three places in the country where I could work. And none of them were on the East Coast. So my wife and I made a decision, you know, that I'd go through a transition. It took 7 years, actually. Me and two other guys, we started a limited partnership in September of 1969. Perfect time to do this, right?
Sure.
And we went through the period from 70 to 74, which was a disaster for small cap value, which we really wanted to do. We didn't lose any money in that period, in that 5 year period. So we were like really heroes. And the broker we were working with, a fellow named Bill Jones, who was then at a company called Laird and Company, it was a DuPont brokerage house down in Wilmington. That lady became Merrill Lynch.
Yep.
He started feeding clients to us. And, but anyway, after 7 years in 76, I felt comfortable enough to leave GE, and I never looked back.
Life is all about these forks in the road that you come to, right? You have to make those decisions.
Well, yeah, I thought that was a good time to do it. Well, you know, my expenses weren't that high. The children were young and just took a chance.
Well, that's a good question, Bob. I mean, you've been investing money for like about 50 years. Is that a fair assessment?
Sure. It's a little more than that, but
what's the exact amount of years, would you say?
It would be 55.
55. Right. No, I'm not sure changing 1 year, because the investment business every year, I know I got to scrub my back for every year I've been in the business. I guess my question is, I mean, that's a long time to be an investor. What are some of the general principles or themes that just never change? And we have an old saying here at our firm that, there's no new eras on Wall Street. So I'm just curious, you know, from your perspective, like what is always the same when it comes to investing?
Well, I was saying to Bob earlier before you came on, and I've told you this too, I've always felt like I bought things that nobody else wanted. A lot of it is personality driven, I feel. And I think there are a lot of different ways to make money. But for me, buying things that are popular is a really dangerous thing. I always felt uncomfortable buying things that are popular.
So could we equate that to Nvidia?
Right.
Amazon, Microsoft, Apple. Does that correlate today to what you're seeing with...
I think so. I look at all the fundamentals, like the PEs and cash flows, just like you guys do. But when something is popular and it almost by definition, you don't know anything that everyone else doesn't know. You know what I mean?
Right.
There's no edge there. I always felt there was an edge by finding things that are more obscure, more out of the limelight in order to obtain value.
Well, I think that makes a lot of sense, Bob, especially like small cap value.
Yeah.
You might have 80 or, a ton of Wall Street analysts following the semiconductors, right, or Microsoft or Amazon. And so, right, what is it known? Everything's known.
Yeah.
Where you have no one following a lot of these small cap value stocks, like not one analyst, which is, if you're going to find some gems, that's where you're going to look.
It was around 2000. I met a guy named Harold Carell. And Harold was the CEO of Southwestern Energy. And Southwestern Energy was some small, obscure utility, natural gas utility. He became CEO, changed the whole thing around, moved the company from the Southeast, I forget exactly where it was, to Houston, and started looking for oil and gas. And that company was the best performing company from 2000 to 2010 on the New York Stock Exchange. Apple was up like 2,000 or 3,000%. Harold's company, Southwestern Energy, was up 5,000%.
Wow.
But no one's ever heard of Southwestern Energy.
But I think the other issue is, and I saw some of your quotes. I found them from 1999, where you were very prophetic. You're talking about how a lot of the momentum stocks at that time, which were super hot, probably wouldn't remain right hot forever. And a lot of these undervalued companies would. Right. And I feel like that's what we're going through right now, is this patience game where, let's face it, when you get outside the Magnificent Seven, semiconductor stocks, I mean, the rest of the markets perform, but on a relative basis, not as well. But I feel like at some point that pendulum's going to swing, but you have to be patient owning a lot of these.
Right.
More obscure or out of favor companies.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of similarities between now and the dot-com era, but I also think there are differences. In the dot-com era, people were really buying junk. I mean, really, there was nothing to a lot of these companies, right? The pet.com and street.com. Many of those companies didn't have revenues. They certainly didn't have profits, but this Magnificent Seven that I guess are the Fabulous Five now, after Apple and Tesla have run into some hardship, they're good companies. I mean, the Magnificent Seven were real companies, obviously, and had something to offer. So in that sense, it's different. But what's the same is the human emotion that goes along with companies becoming overvalued, overextended, and selling at unrealistic prices. I look at a company, I think Tesla was selling at 90 times earnings not too long ago.
130 at one point.
Yeah. I mean, that's crazy. One of the things that I'm very much aware of coming out of engineering and coming into this business is that engineering is a science. This is not a science.
We agree.
This is far from a science. You're trying not to make a big mistake in this business. You don't want to make a big mistake.
Yeah, I think most investors have the problem of discerning the difference between a great company and a great stock.
Mm-hmm.
Tesla can end up being a great company, but when you're paying 130 times earnings, you're paying for perfection.
Right.
And the only reason it gets to that level, again, is because of the emotional buying.
Yeah.
The momentum buying.
Yeah.
Well, are you seeing the same? Because it seems to me a lot of the analysts today had the same kind of projections for, say, an NVIDIA or Supermicro computer. I mean, are we getting to the point where analysts' expectations are getting a little ridiculous with the big names of today? I mean, is that similar or is it not as?
I don't really analyze those companies because I'm not really interested in them. But just on the basis of observation, I think, AI has actually been around a long time, in different forms. I mean, you get these on your phone. You know, you text something, it's self-correcting, right? A lot of AI is not something that's completely new. And all of a sudden it comes out of nowhere, supposedly, and people are just paying enormous amounts of money for anything associated with AI. It doesn't seem real to me. It seems like they're expecting too much too soon at this point.
Well, you know, we own a portion of our portfolio in that area, so we're happy it's going up. But what I don't think most investors recognize is how much opportunity there is in every other asset class right now.
I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
I mean, I own a number of small cap stocks. They're selling at single digit PEs. I think it's really hard to go wrong when you buy something at 5, 6, 7 times earnings, you know, and you're getting paid 5% to wait.
And the abundance of those type of companies.
Yeah.
It's littered with companies like that right now.
Right. So I'm much more comfortable in that arena.
Well, that leads me to another question. I mean, I know a lot of your job was going out and meeting CEOs and management teams.
Yeah, we did that.
How do you know when a CEO is lying?
I really felt that most of the times I was getting the straight scoop. And overwhelmingly, I felt I was getting the straight scoop. It was a rarity when I felt like that I was lied to. I often felt, though, that other analysts didn't believe the management team and they didn't do something. And I did it because I believe the management team.
Less cynicism is better.
I said, well, you know, I told you right here in the quarterly report that this was happening, you know. And so I don't know if it really pays to be that cynical, you know. I mean, you want to be careful and you want to be judicious in your research and analysis, but I wouldn't be too cynical. I think they have too much to lose in terms of their jobs. That's been my personal experience anyway.
Another question I had for you is the Great Financial Crisis was probably one of the worst markets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think any of us have lived through in our lifetime.
Yeah.
What were some of what transpired for you at that time? What lessons did you learn from such a huge meltdown in stocks, the one that we hadn't really seen in a very long time?
Yeah, it really emphasized the fact that you don't want to buy anything that's popular. I mean, we didn't own banks. We didn't own anything. Our exposure to that whole disaster was minimal, really minimal. And I think if you look at our relative performance was really good in that era.
Were you scared when it happened, or do you see it as an opportunity? Did you
our income fund did extremely well because we had a lot of cash and they were buying bonds for 50 cents on a dollar. We are committed to buying things when no one wants them.
Did you see it transpiring? I mean, obviously there was a lot of leverage. The housing market was going crazy. I mean,
we thought it was nuts. And I felt the same thing in COVID. I mean, I was on a phone with one of the guys in this limited partnership I manage. It was actually Harold Carell, the CEO of.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I said, Harold, you know, we could be looking at a bottom now. And this was like the last week in March. And it was. I think it was March 26th. At 2000.
It was like down 20% that day or whatever.
Yeah. I said, you know, it could be happening now. He thought it was crazy. You know, he's you got to be crazy. I said, no, it's acting like this is just give up. This is it. And I didn't know 100%, but I felt, geez, you know, if it's not, what's the difference? Yeah. There's not going to be anything left. You might as well just go in.
Well, I think a lot of folks forget that the markets are backed by real assets. You know, like the valuations can go up and down, but it's stretched or, but ultimately, you know, there's a point where you got to take a stand and it's, you know, you could feel it in your gut, but it didn't mean it couldn't do it again. But it's amazing how emotional the average investor is and how, you know, they don't see, I think loss aversion is a much powerful force than winning, you know, than making money.
Absolutely. But you make a good point. You can learn a lot from your clients. I remember the same experience we had when this particular woman would call, you knew you were close to a bottom.
We have the same negative. Yeah, we have the same negative indicators.
Yeah. Controlling your emotions is really critical. One of my associates, he wasn't in the business, just an individual investor. I saw him lose $28 million because he wouldn't diversify. You know, he had it all in one company. And just changed his life, of course, overnight.
And you know who wasn't diversified, Bob, was me. And fortunately, I trained my son, who became my financial advisor. And literally, I was out training 50 top producers at Morgan Stanley one day. And he called me up and he said, why is it you teach this fabulous diversified strategy that applies to everybody you meet except for you? I'm like, what are you talking about? And of course, you know, I had low cost basis stock, nice dividend.
Right. Yeah.
It was Merrill Lynch. And fortunately, he sold it all.
So Bob,
I probably wouldn't be on this podcast today had you not done that. Right.
I'm hearing is I should get a bigger share of the inheritance. But you know, Bob,
what inheritance? It all went with Merrill Lynch stock.
Hey, hope you're enjoying episode 153, Pain Points of Wealth. Everything you hear on this podcast, along with some due diligence of your own, can help you get ahead financially, literally at any stage of your journey. But if you saved over $1 million for your financial independence plan, and you want a more hands-on approach, Bob, Chris, and I now have a collective 75 years helping individuals just like you with your planning investing. This is what we do every single day. We'll put together for you a total financial master plan. We'll do a bird's eye view of your entire financial life and hone in on every financial issue you need to address today. There's not a firm out there that will do this work up front. In fact, we'll build you your own personalized financial portal. We'll go through and look at everything you need, from an income plan for retirement. How do you draw from your portfolio? How do you take Social Security? We'll do a full deep dive of your total portfolio. Look at your diversification. Have you had way too much money in the market? Have you seen your portfolio go up and down like a yo-yo? Or have you been sitting in cash, paralysis by analysis, can't figure out what to do? We'll put together a full investment game plan. We'll show you how to grow your wealth, tie it to your goals, but most importantly, protect it over the rest of your life. And we'll look at fees and taxes. Wall Street loves to sell you high cost, tax inefficient products, whether it's an annuity, insurance product, structured product, brokerage product. We'll do a deep dive of all those investments, show you how to reduce the cost and optimize your portfolio for taxes. It's not what you make, it's what you take. You'll get a full tax playbook. If you saved over $1 million for your financial independence plan, simply go to www.paincm.com/financial plan or click on the link below to see if you qualify for a free financial review. It's a great point about diversification and spreading the money out. I think that's huge. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, one thing that gets discounted, I think you kind of said it before, is like, and we say this a lot too, it's not about getting all the upside. It's really not about losing your shirt in those horrific downturns. And I think that's where people really get hit. It's not, you know, not missing a move in NVIDIA on the upside, but if it goes down 80% at some point.
Yeah, I think protecting against major losses is really critical.
It is. It's just you need to, and that's kind of why we created our strategy. It's very simple. We call it A to B, but it's, you know, we invest with a purpose, you know, and take as much risk as you need to achieve your financial goals.
Yeah.
Was finding a way to get people emotionally attached to their goals, not to their portfolio. Because if you're attached to it, right. Like Ryan says it all the time, or Chris says it all the time, you know, you can love your stocks, but they're not going to love you back.
No. Right.
And you'll end up hating them when you think they love you.
One of the things you can say at this point is you're not going to make the same amount of money in those stocks over the next 2 or 3 years that people have made in the prior 2 or 3 years. I mean, the bloom is off the rose for sure. I'm not saying that they're going to collapse and all of them are going to go down, but they're not going to do as well. I mean, they've become too popular and there's too much money in them. And that money's more likely to come out than more money go in at this point.
I don't know. I've always found that when something goes up 100%, it has a really hard time going up another 100%.
Yeah.
And it's especially, you know, not so much an individual stock, but a whole group of companies.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
A, you know, a specific group of assets. It's, you know, you just get to that point of diminishing return.
Yeah.
It's so true.
Let me ask you guys a question. I remember working at Pratt & Whitney Aircraft back in the mid-60s, okay? And there were people in that office, now these are engineers primarily, they would go to annual meetings of local companies. They would manage their own stock portfolios. There weren't very many investment advisors around, and the investment advisory industry was what we called a cottage industry. And, you know, now, of course, we've got, you know, multi-trillion dollar Vanguards and BlackRocks and God knows what else. Do you find that there are individuals out there today that are still doing these people did research and in a serious way in investing on their own. I don't know if that exists anymore. And I'm wondering what you guys think.
Yeah, I think that the big difference now is that indexing has become popular, but not so much indexing as the S&P 500 index has become popular. And since it's capitalization weighted, you've got tons and tons of money that are going into the same companies. And I think I see more of that today than I see individuals speculating on stocks or researching stocks.
Right.
I mean, you have the Robin Hood phenomenon where they get together as a community through Reddit and, you know, bid up a stock to try and, you know, beat a hedge fund manager, right? To get them to close their shorts. I see some of that. And those people are, they're very small investors and they're, you know, they're almost cult-like in their belief. I mean, if you speak to them, it's like, you know, no, you just don't, you're an old dude, Bob. You don't understand. This is the new way of doing things. I'm like, really? This is the new way. Okay. And of course I think that's going to end in tears. So, but I think the big issue today, and that's the thing and Ry, you just did a recent study on that. Looking at all the different index funds and all the growth funds and all the money going into actually the same companies over and over and over. And I don't think the average investor knows they're doing that.
I don't think so either.
Yeah. Well, that brings another question. I mean, because of that, is it easier or is it hard to exploit opportunities with small cap stocks? I know you were famous for buying very, very like micro cap companies.
Yes.
Because they had very little research. There's a lot to exploit there in terms of just the knowledge about those stocks wasn't there. Do you think today it's harder or easier?
That's a very good question. I think in some respects it's easier. In other respects, it's more difficult. I think you can find them and you can invest in them, but you may have to be more patient today. I remember there was a period of time where 25% of all the stocks we owned, and this was probably in the early 80s, were acquired. Doesn't happen anymore.
No.
Years ago,
no.
You looked at a balance sheet, there was a substantial amount of assets under property. I mean, companies had a lot of real assets. Today, in our service-oriented economy, there's not much to acquire, really. It's intellectual property, and we, you know, we can do that ourselves. In many respects, there were real assets that people went after. They'd see a company selling at a half a book, a quarter of book value. I mean, we used to buy companies under in market bottoms that if there were small companies, you could get them for a quarter of book value.
Right. Because you could liquidate the whole company and make a return, basically.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me, if you ever watched the movie Wall Street, which I assume you have, because if you can't be in our business and not watch that movie.
Yeah.
Where Gordon Gekko, he buys the airline, and what's he do right away? He goes to liquidate. So maybe that was something to that in the early 80s.
Yeah.
that was the strategy of the time.
Right.
Well, you know, the other thing I noticed, Bob, is that when we review a lot of portfolios, the one area that most investors don't have any money in is small cap value.
Right.
They might have small growth, but very rarely do they have small value in the portfolio.
So it's a good time to buy small caps is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I think so.
Let me ask you this. I mean, I feel like, you know, this business, and you've been to the mountain back a couple times, Bob.
Yeah.
Is one of the few businesses where you get a lot better with age. I mean, if you look at Warren Buffett, he probably made some of his best trades, arguably, in the last couple of years with Apple.
Yeah.
About those Japanese trading companies.
Right.
They made a big play in oil.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like with your accumulation of knowledge, you're getting better at investing? you're still learning at this stage of the game, or, you know, what's your view on that?
And I find with myself, though, I don't spend the time that I used to spend 20 years ago where, you know, I'd get up and go into the office every day.
Sure.
So, you know, that's a whole different thing. But I don't think if I stay home someday and just do my research and whatever, and I do a lot of that, I don't feel like I've lost anything. And I feel like, in a lot of ways, I'm a better investor.
Why a better investor? What do you think are some of the things that you do now that you didn't do in the past?
Well, when I talk to a company, and I don't talk to companies as much, but the last week I was on the phone with a CEO, and I think I'm a lot more sophisticated. I've been on the boards of a couple of public companies over the decades. And, I know what goes on in boardrooms, and, I think I'm a much better interrogator, if you could use that word, of a CEO than I was, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. You're right. You gain this experience and knowledge, and you can kind of separate, you know, things that are important from things that aren't as important.
So what's an interrogating question you'd ask a CEO today? Relaxed, that you might not have done in the past?
Over my career, I think I've removed about 4 CEOs.
Explain that. Like, you got them fired, or?
Like, I remember one, it was an oil company down in Houston. I went to the annual meeting and I pointed out that this guy had wasted $75 million, you know, drilling wildcat, holes in the ground. And the company had nothing to show for it. He could have acquired, you know, a small producing company at that time. And I said I wanted to sit down and talk to the board after their meeting. And he was gone. Not immediately, wow. But within a few months, he was gone.
He didn't like you.
No, he didn't like me. I didn't like him.
He didn't like the dry holes he was drilling either.
He sat across the table from me. And he said, well, you know, that's what happens in the oil business. I said, no, that's what happens in the oil business with you running it. You get a certain maturity. You might not have that when you're in your 20s and 30s, but you start to develop it.
Yeah, I think it, you know, once you, especially when you have 50 years in the business, there are certain things that you don't make the same mistake twice.
Yeah.
So I think, and like, there are certain areas you don't even bother to investigate because you know it doesn't end well. It's not a good place to go.
Right.
It's a combination of, you don't have as much energy as you had, but you also have a lot of wisdom.
Yeah.
And that wisdom's worth a lot of money.
Yeah.
I'm going to change the script a little bit here. You know, you've obviously had a lot of success in your career, but can you tell us a little bit, like, how did you grow up? I mean, what was your relationship with money as a kid?
I didn't have much of a relationship with money. We didn't have any. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. Father was a blue collar person. A lot of love in the family. I went to Brooklyn Tech High School, and then went to City College in New York, where I studied chemical engineering. But I was a street kid.
What's it mean to be a street kid back in Brooklyn? What was that like?
We didn't belong to a country club. I played stickball, played baseball over in Prospect Park, you know, and got into fights with people because we thought this was our field and they thought it was their baseball field.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah.
When we asked all our guests, but was there a song or an album that when you heard it for the first time, that it completely changed your view of your view of the world, rather?
I don't think so. I like the Bee Gees.
Did disco change your life, Bob? Is that what you're trying to tell us?
Not exactly.
But staying alive on as you
hit those weights. Staying alive, yeah. Yes.
Thanks for listening to The Pain Points of Wealth. Hopefully, you found the ideas discussed in this episode valuable and useful for your own financial journey. You can find out more about Bob, Ryan, and Chris's firm, Payne Capital Management, at bebullish.com or through the contact information found in the description of this episode in your podcast player or app. Join us next week for another episode of The Pain Points of Wealth, brought to you by Payne Capital Management. Information provided on today's show is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment, tax, or legal advice. Investment is obtained from sources that are deemed to be reliable, but their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed.